Wisconsin's governor escapes the recall.
What does that mean for organized labor?
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, June the 6th.
Coming up, will NASDAQ pay for the Facebook snafu?
And speak the lingo like a Wall Street insider.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker will keep his job after winning yesterday's recall election. That win has obvious political implications, but it's also got implications for organized labor. Unions led the recall effort after Walker trimmed their power in the state. Andy Stern is the former head of the Service Employees International Union, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, as a former leader of the labor movement, what's your reaction to this recall election?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I'm disappointed. I think what Scott Walker did sort of crossed the lines of Wisconsin values, but the voters have voted, and now it's time to move on.
Well, what do you make of the fact, though, that according to the exit polls, even people who live in union households were evenly split in this recall election between Walker and his opponent, Barrett?
I think we always have to understand that union households means spouses, children, and is a much broader category than simply union members. But it certainly means that there was more education work that needed to be done, or a sense that some of the workers probably in the private sector feel like some of the issues here weren't really things they supported. But I also think recall elections are very different. A lot of people just don't believe it's right, you know, to recall anybody in the midterm. And so I think there's a special consideration here.
Well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, the labor movement is a lot smaller in this country right now than it was decades ago. And this recall election seems to indicate that that trend continues.
Yeah, I mean, I think until both the labor movement modernizes itself, you know, and America decides that it really wants to find a way for workers to share in success and not have this inequality. You know, I think the labor movement is unfortunately on the cutting edge, you know, of where the action is. But in the end, this is really going to be bad for American workers.
Andy Stern is the former president of the Service Employees International Union. He is now a senior fellow at the Richmond Center at Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There was no cut in interest rates from the European Central Bank today, but some would like the ECB to take action soon. Earlier today, the bank's chief, Mario Draghi, acknowledged that there's, quote, heightened uncertainty weighing on confidence and sentiment that's hurting the economic outlook. But there's a limit to what his bank can do, as Christopher Wirth reports from London.
The European Central Bank is like a pared-down version of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Both set interest rates and control inflation, but while the U.S. Central Bank has more powers, the ECB isn't responsible for financial stability. Holger Schmieding, an economist at Germany's Berenberg Bank, says that's a problem.
The current circumstances were simply not foreseen when the ECB was created.
Current circumstances being the debt crisis. Colin McCarthy, an economist at University College Dublin, says that's left the ECB locked in a stare down with European politicians over who needs to take action.
The European Central Bank is, if you like, staring back at the politicians and saying that we're at the limit of what we're allowed to do.
Some hope the ECB to take more unprecedented measures, like pumping money into troubled Eurozone banks. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
There's a new sign this morning that the economic powerhouse known as Germany does not stand aloof from the European financial crisis. The credit rating agency Moody's today downgraded 7 German banks, noting their exposure to Europe's debt problems and slower economic growth. Even the second largest bank in Germany, Commerzbank, is on the list. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Berlin today on a swing through Eurozone countries grappling with the financial mess. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, David.
Germans love dispensing austerity. Any chance that that's beginning to change as a prescription for what ails Europe?
Nein. Germany is still saying no to a lot of the solutions that are being urged upon it by its Eurozone partners, such as Eurobonds. It is still saying no to a new idea, the use of European Union bailout funds to directly prop up the Spanish banks.
Do Germans not fully appreciate the connection between their general economic success and the fact that some of these troubled countries like Spain, Portugal, Greece are the ones who buy German goods, which helps German success.
Yes, I think they do. And they also appreciate that the cost of a breakup would be enormous in all sorts of ways. Loss of markets, but also, of course, loss of the hundreds of billions of euros that Germany has lent to the weaker countries like Spain, Ireland, Italy. Some of the ordinary Germans that I was talking to in a club here last night were talking about their fear that Germany might be blamed for wrecking Europe. After spending more than 60-odd years apologising and making amends for the mayhem they caused during the Second World War. But this is a big dilemma. They want the euro to survive, but they don't want to sign a blank cheque before the next general election next year.
But any sense of movement, in other words, the sense that the EU may now face an existential threat. It could, if Greece falls out of the eurozone, begin to break up. And so now is time for a new kind of thinking about Europe. Are you detecting any of that?
Well, that certainly is in the air. And I think a lot of people that I was talking to last night were referring to George Soros, the fund manager, his observation at the weekend that Europe has only 3 months to save the euro. There is the possibility there might be some modification, but the Germans, they want to save the euro, but not at any cost.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Berlin today. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Stephen is now headed to Spain, by the way, where the prime minister today said his country is in, quote, extreme difficulty and is explicitly asking for European money to bolster some troubled Spanish banks. For more on the world's economic difficulties, we turn to Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, who's with us, as he is, every Wednesday. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with, I guess, the problem that's being talked about more and more right now, and that is that the world economy is starting to slow down a little. Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor, said last night he thinks the chances the U.S. is heading back into a recession are very low. What do you think?
So China is probably in technical recession already or headed there very shortly. Europe is basically a giant recession. It's very tough for us to say that the U.S. can decouple. So we'll have trouble. It doesn't mean that we necessarily have to have a contraction, but it wouldn't be all that surprising. So I think at this point, we're kind of looking at the as like a 40% probability.
40%. A lot of people are looking to central banks for help, and I want to ask you about that because I just mentioned that the ECB did not change their interest rate. And I saw an article today headlined, "Save us, Bernanke, you're our only hope." Should the central banks be doing more?
What a bullish headline that is. You know, at a certain point, and you've heard this term used before probably by me, the central banks are really pushing on a string. In the context of a balance sheet recession, when people still need to delever, adding more liquidity doesn't do very much other than deflating the actual cost of the debt. So I think, obviously, people are expecting central banks at a certain point to come up with the grand compromise that will include money printing and lowering rates, but it's also going to have to include things like easing off on the austerity demands of countries that simply can't afford it anymore, rotating debt around, recapitalizing banks. It's never just one tool. It's never just one fix when things get to this point.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Published reports today suggest the NASDAQ stock exchange is working on a plan to compensate brokerages that lost perhaps $100 million when NASDAQ software fouled up the start of trading in Facebook's new stock last month. Marketplace's David Gura is in Washington and has been looking into this. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is NASDAQ trying to do?
Well, first of all, they're trying to figure out what went wrong exactly, how despite thousands of hours of testing, they had these big technical issues. And second, they're trying to ascertain how much money traders actually lost. And third, they're trying to assess their legal liability here. When there's a technical glitch like this one, to what degree is NASDAQ responsible? And I should say, there are these reports NASDAQ will give us more insight into this today when they're expected to file a plan here in Washington. I talked to Jim Angel. He's a finance professor at Georgetown, and he says NASDAQ has to play this carefully.
They've just burned their best customers. They better make it up to them in some way, or those customers will take their order flow someplace else.
So, David, what does this mean for NASDAQ in particular?
I mean, these exchanges are competing against each other for business. Here's Jim Angel again.
NASDAQ enjoyed a very good reputation for having solid technology systems, and whenever there's a big glitch like this, it certainly is a black eye for NASDAQ.
Besides having a solid reputation for its trading systems, NASDAQ has been seen as the place to go for big-name tech companies looking to go public. And NASDAQ's fear now is that other companies, including other companies in Silicon Valley, David, may decide to go elsewhere, namely to the exchange's biggest rival, the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, the good old New York Stock Exchange. Thank you very much, Marketplace's David Gura. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Senate has started working on a 5-year extension of the Farm Bill. Well, it's called the Farm Bill, but in fact, 80% of the bill goes to fund food stamps. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
Elizabeth Lauerbach has been glued to the debate about the Farm Bill. She's a poverty expert at the Center for Law and Social Policy, and she's keeping a close eye on the fate of the food stamp program this year. But she says that's not why most people pay attention to the Farm Bill.
The people who pay a lot of attention to it are, frankly, the agricultural interests. And so they're really mobilized to defend subsidy programs.
What people are not so mobilized to defend is food stamps, Lauerbach says. And that worries her, especially now when 44 million Americans depend on them, nearly double pre-recession numbers. And as food stamp spending has grown, it's become more of a target for big cuts. Robert Rector is with the Heritage Foundation.
It's a one-way handout, so we have to look at this spending in a reasonable way when we're making choices about how to reduce future deficits.
What some see as making hard choices about future deficits, others see as balancing the budget on the backs of the poor. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
In Washington today, bank regulators will be on Capitol Hill to update senators on Wall Street reform. It's been almost 2 years since Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law to fix the flaws that led to the 2008 economic meltdown. Well, since then, regulators, with a lot of input from lobbyists, have been trying to figure out how the law should be implemented. Marketplace's John Dimsdale now has a look at their progress.
Over 2,300 pages long, Dodd-Frank imposed new financial requirements on banks, brought their complex trades out into the open, and was designed to protect consumers. Michael Greenberger is a former director of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. He says there's still a long way to go.
For the most part, we are still operating under the regulatory regime that was in place when we experienced the meltdown in September 2008.
Of Dodd-Frank's 400 new rules, more than half have missed their deadlines. Michael Barr says that's because Congress is underfunding the regulators. Barr is a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury who helped write Dodd-Frank.
The real risk right now is this kind of collective amnesia that you see in some quarters saying we should roll back the clock and bring back the financial system we had that really crushed the American economy.
Barr says last month's revelations that J.P. Morgan lost billions in risky trades reminded people why Dodd-Frank was necessary in the first place. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right, David, so let me say a sentence to you and see if you can figure out what I'm talking about. The ECB refused to loosen, although sentiment suggests some kind of new QE might happen soon.
I get an F for that kind of business okay. writing.
Get an F, and fair enough. We try on this show always to take that kind of jargon out, but sometimes it slips right back in, which is why we're going to bring in now our colleague Patty Hirsch. He's Marketplace's resident explainer. You know him perhaps from the whiteboard financial explanation videos at marketplace.org. Patty, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, Patty, let's start with a word that every time I hear it, I wonder, do people really know what this word means? Because we didn't hear it until recently, and that is austerity.
Yeah, up until the recent unpleasant events, right? Pretty much the only time you'd hear the word austerity or austere would be in some literary reference to a person's simple clothing or living arrangements.
Like a monk or something.
Exactly. So when we're trying to understand words like this, I always like to return to the original Greek.
How appropriate.
Indeed. In this case, austeros, which means bitter or harsh. And it's a word that people in the wine business from time to time use to describe wines that make your tongue very dry.
Probably wines that you would find in places that are having to have a little austerity right now.
Right. You know, Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, although maybe not so much in Ireland.
Well, what about another word that we're going to be hearing more of soon, and that is sequestration?
Right. We're hearing this word sequestration a lot in reports about the budget. And it's one of these really legal words that's kind of found its way into common language.
Yeah. Yeah, you usually hear about sequestration, like you're sequestering a jury.
Right, which means the jury's isolated during a trial. And the original meaning of the Latin word sequester is trustee or mediator. Hmm. But the way we're hearing the word used today is much more aggressive. In this congressional context, the sequestration of the budget means quite simply that a certain amount of the budget money, has been held back by the Treasury before it's even paid. It's been confiscated, if you like.
Well, while you're talking about the Treasury, let's focus on another thing that has to do with Washington and politics, and that is Mitt Romney's time in the private equity business. And I want you to just focus on the word equity.
Right. Equity is one of these words that's sometimes misunderstood because of its really wide usage. You know, in a business show, you might hear the word used three ways.
Right.
You might hear about investors moving money from bonds to equities, right? You might hear about private equity, of course. And you might also hear about people tapping the equity in their homes.
Right, to get some cash out of their house.
Right. But equity really only means one thing. It means a share, whether it's a share in a public company, a share in a private company, or a share in your house, which, of course, you share with the person who's lent you the money, which is the bank. That word equity means just one thing, a share.
Marketplace's resident explainer, Patty Hirsch, who does the whiteboard explainer videos at our website, marketplace.org. Patty, thanks so much, and we look forward to talking with you about some more words soon.
I look forward to it too, Jeremy. Thank you.
The History Channel has Pawn Stars, A&E has Storage Wars, and now Spike TV is introducing its own TV show that's supposed to reflect our economic downturn. The show is called World's Worst Tenant and will act out crazy but apparently true stories of foreclosures and evictions.
Here to talk with us about this in today's Midday Extra is Tim Malloy, TV editor of The Wrap. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. So what's going on here? Is this art imitates life?
Well, it's interesting because this is a show that's actually doing reenactments. And I guess you can kind of see why. I mean, they're going after people in a really humiliating moment. And I guess in some ways it's much better that they're using actors rather than showing us that low moment in someone's life.
You all worried, as I guess I already am, that this is going to vilify people who are actually victims?
Yeah, you know, I talked to Spike's executive VP of original series last year, Sharon Levy, when this show was first announced, and she insists that this show in particular will really be, quote, a glimpse of the absurd. So it's really not a case of making fun of the average tenants who are being evicted, but she says really looking at ridiculous cases like people who were raising bees in their house or, you know, have a horse or something like that. But clearly it is a reflection of, you know, the economic downturn and follows a trend, as you noted, of shows like Repo Games and Pawn Games.
It's clear what's going on here in terms of you take situations where people are under enormous pressure and then dramatic things happen, and that's how you can build a show around that idea.
Yeah, and why reality shows work is that you're taking supposedly real situations and, you know, getting to see those situations amplified. This show, I'm not really sure how it's going to fly because it isn't even the real situations. I mean, they're reenacting these situations with actors. So if that's the kind of thing that you enjoy, where's the drama or where's sort of the fix of, you know, enjoying seeing someone else's unhappiness? I mean, you know, God forbid that that's the kind of thing you like.
Tim, I have to say, I mean, thank you so much for doing this. But I want to say, you know, after all of the depressing things we cover in the economy, this really upsets me that they're doing this show. But anyway, we'll take a look and give it a watch. Tim Malloy, TV editor at The Wrap. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A story now about President Obama's fundraiser tomorrow morning in Los Angeles.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
The president is headed to breakfast in the View Park neighborhood in L.A. Carol Thompson lives there.
We heard about him going to George Clooney's house. That's money. This community doesn't have that kind of money.
View Park is an upper middle class area in South Los Angeles that's majority African American. Wealth and Poverty reporter Shireen Meraji has the story.
When you ask people who live in View Park to describe their neighborhood, they always mention the celebrities.
I can Tina Turner stayed across the street.
Right across the street.
And you had Nancy Wilson around the corner.
The only one who could ever please him was a good-loving son of a preacher man.
What View Park residents like Steve and Dina Hearn don't brag about are the local schools.
What parent wants to send their kids to a school when you walk in, you go through a metal detector? Mm. I don't think so.
The median income in View Park is more than $80,000 a year, and nearly half its residents have college degrees. But low-income, high-crime neighborhoods are less than 2 miles away.
That's a basic fact that
the black middle class is more likely to face than the white middle class.
Angela James is a sociologist who teaches at Loyola Marymount University.
Their homes are valued less because they're close to poor communities, and they are more likely to have been responsible for paying for their own education rather than being able to draw upon family wealth to do so.
James says because their houses don't appreciate as much, it's more difficult to draw on that equity to pay for their children's education.
And so you see how the cycle of wealth inequality continues.
A fact that View Park residents Steve and Dina Hearn know firsthand. Steve's a retired mechanic. Dina's a community college dean.
Nothing was ever handed down to us. Our parents were not in a position to help us. And you know, with the economy the way it is, it could be behind us tomorrow. You just never know.
As proof, the Hearns point out the foreclosures on their block, 4 in the last 5 years. And that block is just minutes from where President Obama is holding his $2,500 a plate fundraiser tomorrow. I'm Shereen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Weigh in on what you think the middle class looks like with a picture. It's the Middle Class Photo Project at marketplace.org. Well, David, a lot of people have different ideas on how you live to 100. The journal Aging has just published the results of a study of adults aged 95 to 107 to find out their secrets. Aside from good genes, the surveyed centenarians were also optimistic, easygoing. They laughed a lot and they didn't bottle up their emotions. Along the same lines, by the way, I got this aging advice from a friend who is still kicking well into her 90s. Never hold a grudge.
Wow. Jeremy has something touching today. That's good advice. All right. And finally, a guy who writes for a blog called Ocracoke Island Journal is on his e-reader the other day. He's going through War and Peace, as one does. And he spots sentences like, Captain Tushin sat down by a bonfire the soldiers had nooked on the road. And also, nook in all hearts the flame of virtue. Well, it didn't sound like Tolstoy to him. And yes, he is using a nook reader for this. Turns out the company that prepared the text had swapped the word nook for every instance of Kindle through the overzealous use of find and replace.
Oh, boy.
We'll check every Kindle and cranny to see if the competition gets revenge.
That story nooked my interest, David.
In New York, I'm David Brancaccia.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.